You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny. Welcome back to the Reading Envy podcast. Today, I have a repeat guest who hasn't been here for a while. It's Carol Ann. Welcome back, Carol Ann.
Hi, Jenny. It's just great to be here. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Yeah, me too. Carol Ann previously appeared on episodes 103 and 164, and you are at the Book and Beyond on Instagram for people who want to follow you there. And I will link to her in Goodreads and Instagram in the show notes. So just go check those out. Carol Ann, how has your year been? How has your reading year been? We're headed into almost the mid part of the year at this point.
I just love reading, but this last year, it's been so weird for everybody. I started working from home last March, so it's been over a year ago now that I've been at home. Boy, by the time this past January hit, I was just losing enthusiasm for a lot of things, and particularly reading, and that just distressed me a lot. I was really worried about it and was looking for ways to kind of spark that up again. And I ran across a gal named Susan Macbeth that runs an organization called Adventures by the Book. And she's been in business for quite a while. She's got a lot of experience with event planning, but also in the book industry and connections with authors. But she pivoted things to virtual once COVID hit. And where the authors weren't able to go out and do their book tours and such, she was putting on events to allow them to do that virtually. And so you could register for these events and have an opportunity to meet the authors. And the way she set it up was just so personalized that you actually got to speak to the authors. That was really fun. My daughter joined me on one of them. They had one called Superbook Sunday, which was on Super Bowl Sunday. They had three different panels of authors from the East Coast, the West Coast, and then from Europe. And you could join one or all of the panels. We joined the West ones. The two in particular that I was really interested in was Susan Meisner and Mark Sullivan, because my daughter, one of her favorite books is Beneath the Scarlet Sky by Mark T. Sullivan. Have you read that one?
I have not, but I bought it because I thought my book club was going to pick it one year, so I have it.
Well, my daughter just absolutely loved that book. So we attended this event, and she got to speak to him. And she was so funny because in the chat, you know how you can message each other back and forth. And she's telling me, oh my God, I'm totally fangirling right now. It was really fun. Anyway, so we got to do that. And that just really sparked the enthusiasm to start reading again. And through that, I've been able to order some new books. And through Susan Meisner, she did a separate event that was just to promote her book, The Nature of Fragile Things, and her presentation was fantastic, and that got me very excited about reading again.
It's so nice when that happens, when you're in that slump and something takes you out of it.
Oh, it is. And I think one of the other things I really love about this organization that Susan Macbeth has put together is she's also got something called the Novel Network, and it's set up for book clubs and readers and authors. But she calls it sort of a match.com for book clubs. They've got an entire database of all these different authors that book clubs can see what the books, their releases are. And you can schedule virtual meetings with the author for your book club. And we've done that a couple times. And boy, that really just bumps it up a big notch in making the meetings a lot of fun.
That's so neat. And I mean, it's making sense to me now, but I think I wouldn't have thought there'd be a use for a book-related event planner. I should contact her because I've always wanted to host a reader's retreat.
Yes.
But I don't want to have to plan it. Well, like, you know, the detail parts, I really don't. That's not my skill set.
Oh, no kidding. I mean, for people who do this for a living, it's not a big deal. For me, I would be pulling my... She does, in addition to these things I've talked about, one of their things is a tour they go on. I think the one that they're hoping to be able to do this fall is in October in the New England states.
Neat. It, like a literary tour?
Yes.
This is not a paid advertisement, by the way. Just just a cool thing.
Something like that. I agree with you that planning a reading retreat, I've thought about it a lot of times, even just grabbing my friends and going on a reading retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else isn't planning it. Yeah, it could be chaos for me.
Absolutely. Like once you get more than two people, then you have to have housing and itineraries and food. And it's just, yeah, it's right. Too much. The New England tour is interesting. I also have discovered, like if you're someone who just wants to take your own little self-guided tour, a lot of states have created literary maps and you can like go to the state website and find them. Like I know North Carolina has very elaborate ones, but even South Carolina has them. And then you can like drive around to places of authors that you're interested in and sometimes tour some homes and stuff. So I always, that's kind of like a low effort way.
No, and you know, that would be really fun because you could do that really low key. Like yeah. You say, just grab a friend or two and go do something like that. And that would be a lot of fun. And
yeah. So your daughter reads.
Yes.
That's good. I know sometimes not all of our friends and family are readers, even if it's really important to us. And you were talking about, I think, is Hidden Brains a podcast?
Yeah, The Hidden Brain. I think it's an NPR podcast,
mm-hmm.
but it's very fascinating. They just talk about different things to do with the brain and how things work. And I was listening to an episode here the other day that struck me so hard. It was my love of reading and why I love it so much and my friends don't. And this episode on this podcast really struck that with me as to what some of the reasons might be. And what he honed in on was that just as humans, we have this innate drive to learn and make sense of our world around us. And we do that through several different methods, but two that are on opposite ends of the spectrum are one is through stories, where you get the details and visual images and emotion. And then on the other end of the scale, you've got more of the explanations that bring in, you know, like the laws of nature or facts of things that we know. It's just the learning part of it explained. But anyway, through the process of this, the point he was making was that we try to pull this information together to connect dots in an effort to create order and just extract order and regularity and stuff about the world around us so we can predict things and feel more comfortable in our surroundings and such. And he said that through the stories, I mean, with books, as the example he gave, authors that do it well will hook you right in the beginning with mystery and confusion and uncertainty. And that's really the truth, right? You open up a book and what keeps the pages turning is we've got to know what happens, right? So they take all this confusion and mystery and uncertainty, and then at the end, they wrap it up into an explanation of what happened. And when we get a satisfying explanation, when we can connect all those dots, it gives us this big pulse or burst of pleasure. The same thing happens with science, I guess, from the people, my friends and stuff that don't read, they like novels and that kind of stuff, but they do like to read more like nonfiction or how to do things, you know, manuals and stuff like that. And I think they do it from the other direction. So they come from the explanation side of things and connect the dots through stories and stuff.
So. Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. I wonder sometimes if people who, you know, they get their narrative fix in another way, like maybe they're really into a TV series or maybe they journal.
Right.
So maybe they're like making sense of their own life or something instead.
Well, yeah, it could be all sorts of things. He interviewed someone. She was given the explanation of, say, this guy that had been placed in prison, and he had just certain number of facts, And while he was in prison, he thought about these things. So he's not gaining new information, but through the pondering, she called it learning by thinking. So by pondering this stuff, like we do with books, how books stick with you and you'll sit and think about things. And then you start connecting the dots and you have that aha moment of learning through these things that we ponder about them.
It's just so interesting. This is kind of a tangent, but I know this month is Autism Awareness Month, for instance. And there was someone who posted something the other day. I think they were reposting someone else. So I have no idea where it came from. I would never be able to find it again. But someone who is autistic was talking about how one of their strengths is that they can make connections between things better than other people can. So like you could hand them a folder or a stack of folders about like a court case, for instance. And once they'd read everything, they would be able to tell you how everything connects and what was missing. And that seems like the same kind of sense making with from the fact side, though. Like if you sat and pondered facts, like maybe there's a way to turn it into a narrative even.
Right. Kind
of cool.
Right. So with the explanations and stuff like you're talking about through the thinking and the reasoning, then they connect the dots to create the story.
Yeah. Brains are cool.
Oh my gosh. It's just so fascinating.
I will link to that episode because I listen to that podcast, like not on a regular basis, but every so often someone links me to a specific topic in there. I remember listening to the one that talked to Lisa Wade, who's author of American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus. And they talked a lot about how college student brains think about sex and relationships and how different it is and how it's a reflection of the fact that their brains aren't mature yet. Fascinating.
So we often read books like fables or little stories to our kids to help them to gain a lesson where we want to impart some wisdom to them about our values and how to treat other people and different things like that. And they played this very, very short clip off of an animated program on TV, Clifford the Big Red Dog. Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
I do too. Anyway, in this particular scene, there is Clifford and a couple of his friends, and then there's another little dog there that only has three legs. Clifford's like, I think he wants to play with us. And he's like, we should let him. And the other two are afraid. And they're just like, oh, I don't know. And they're really apprehensive about it. So they said, after that clip or that episode was played, they talked to the children to see what they drew from that. And she said, majority of them drew a complete blank. Or more specifically, the idea they gained from that was that it's important to be nice to three-legged dogs.
Right. Because they take everything literally.
Literally, right.
Yeah, they can't make those connections of these higher order thinking patterns. They just...
Right. So maybe, you know, along the lines with college students, I don't know. But but she just pointed out that if, you know, if we discuss it with them afterwards, we can help them. So by prompting them, sort of like we would do in book club, you know, we prompt each other about why the characters did what they did. And just it can give you a broader perspective. You can see other sides of things and broadens your understanding.
Wow, that's so great. What do you talk to your friends about who don't read?
Well, we don't talk about books. No, that's not true because I talk about books all the time.
Yeah.
The clue is I don't say, I just read a book that said, because the minute I say that, they're like, oh, geez, here we go. But I'll just say, you know, I learned something new the other day, and I'll say whatever it was I learned.
Yeah.
Anyway, then we can just keep good conversations. It's all in the presentation, right?
That's right. Well, I guess we can get to the books that we brought to talk about. We both brought books to talk about that we liked recently. Would you like to go first?
Sure. The first one I wanted to talk about was the Susan Meisner book that I learned about, you know, from her book tour. It's her new one that came out just recently, The Nature of Fragile Things. Her presentation on this book had me so excited to receive it and start reading. The backdrop to the story is the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. Her presentation was really good about all the history, what San Francisco looked like before, what happened during the earthquake, and then the devastation that occurred afterwards and stuff. There was so much that I didn't realize. Did you realize there were big fires?
Oh, yeah.
So I just didn't ever pay attention to that part of history, I guess. But she explained how, even though they're right there by the ocean, that the earthquake had broken all the pipes and stuff, and they couldn't get water to put out the fires. And they actually, the fires were spreading so fast and were so devastating that they dynamited blocks of homes down Van Ness Avenue to try to stop the fire. And it worked. But by the time all was said and done, wait, the city was just obliterated. But the people were determined to rebuild. And that was pretty cool. But anyway, that is the backdrop to this story. It's about this Irish immigrant. She's come over and is living in New York City in pretty squalid conditions. And she sees an ad in the newspaper for a mail order bride for a man who lives in San Francisco. He's a widower and has a little daughter. She decides to answer it. And he sends her a picture of himself and explains his life. And she sends him a picture and they decide to meet up. And she travels out there. And he's really a handsome, charming guy. And his daughter is just adorable. But it's not very long into it that she's figuring out he's not quite what he represents himself to be, but she hasn't put her finger on things just yet. And the day that she figures out what is actually going on is the day before the earthquake. So her world basically ends, you know, is just blown up the day before the earthquake, and the next morning the earthquake hits. So not only is her relationship world blown up, but her city, her whole world is just messed up. And so it's just there's lots of twists and turns. And in the end, it's a real good story about, you know, strength and solidarity and companionship, the friends that she did find, and then, you know, the will of people to help each other and get through difficult times. And like I said, rebuild the city and stuff. Really a good story. But I tell you, it was so weird because when I ended the story, it kept me turning the pages. But when I finished, I was so disappointed. And I think it was not the fault of the author. Have you ever done this? I went into that story with certain preconceived notions. In other books that I've read with her, I've really connected with her characters and have loved them. And of course, I think we've talked about this before too. I just really love character-driven stories.
Yeah.
And I went into it with that idea. And that was my fault because the story is wonderful and her writing is wonderful. It was my fault going into it with that idea. I think this is really much more a plot-driven story. And it's real strong on the historical content. So if you know that going in, I think you'll enjoy it so much, but I just have to remind myself that when I'm going into a story of, you know, am I setting myself up with incorrect perceptions going in?
Yeah, it's like you have to think about, you have to kind of like talk yourself through it at the end. Like, was this my expectation that just wasn't met? Did I want the author to be writing a different book?
Right.
Yeah. And it's so interesting actually, because the New York Times review for the book I'm going to talk about first, which it's not time to get to that yet, but it was basically that. It was like, if I had written this book, I would have made different decisions. So does that mean I don't like it?
Right.
That's not really the same thing.
It's not. I think it's sometimes too much information about the book is not a good thing. Sometimes when I go into the book not knowing a whole lot, I come out just thinking it was the best book ever. And I think if I had done that with this one, I wouldn't have had the same outcome that I did. Because when I think about it, she wrote exactly the kind of book she set out to write.
Right.
And it was intriguing and it was fun. It was me that went into it thinking I was going to get to know more about the characters. And
yeah.
I did.
By the time the story ends, without spoiling it, do you feel like the woman who found this stuff out has resolution in her life? Like, is there an ending to that story?
Yes, it has a very good ending. I mean, it is satisfying in that regard. But the other thing I really love in books is surprises, right? Mm. Well, I didn't see that coming, you know. And there are several of those in this, which makes it great.
But still not the book that you're wanting. I totally get that.
Yeah. So I hope that doesn't discourage anyone, because just if you're going into it, just know it is historical fiction and it's really great on the historic part of it, but it is plot driven.
Well researched, sounds like. Yeah. I mean, man, all I did while you were talking is I Googled SF 1906 earthquake fires and the pictures are incredible.
Oh, it's amazing. And you know, when I attended that event, that Super Big Sunday, and Susan Meisner was there, and then I did her book tour, basically, for that book, her presentation. When I received the book signed by her, this was so cool. It made me feel so special. She included a little note, hand-signed by her, and then there's five photographs in it, small photographs. They're historical photos. A couple of them are of the San Francisco quake. And then the other three are of the characters. She's gotten old pictures that are what she imagined these characters looked like. So she's got Martin and Sophie and then the little girl.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was just so neat to get that with the book. It was such a personal touch.
Oh, that's neat.
So what's your first book?
Okay, well, my first book is Brood by Jackie Poulsen. And I think this is a debut novel. So I'd seen some mixed reviews of this, and actually I ended up moving it up my list because people were talking about this review in the New York Times. The review is by another author, Elizabeth McCracken, and she wrote The Giant's House and other books like that. Okay, so the narrator is unnamed, but you find out pretty early on that prior to when the novel starts, she's had a miscarriage, and she's had one, she's older, probably upper 30s, not like older, older. But that has set some things in motion, and she's, you know, probably grieving that. But the other thing that she's done before the novel has started is that she's gotten these four chickens. So she talks about these chickens a lot. It's the focus of the novel. She talks about the chickens with her friend that comes over. She talks about the chickens with her husband, who has applied for a job in another state, and he's probably going to get it. She talks about the chickens with her mother. And those are the only other people that are really in the novel. They each have their own personality, of course, as chickens do. And
I love a good chicken.
It's kind of written almost in a creative nonfiction kind of approach, where it almost reminded me of Moby Dick, except for not that scale. It's a much, much smaller book. But you know how in Moby Dick, if you've ever actually managed to read it, which not a lot of us can,
yeah.
It's kind of like a treatise on whales with a little bit of a novel in there. You know, at least that's how I see it. And this kind of feels like that at the beginning. Like, there's a lot of stuff about chickens. Like, I was like, I don't know really about this. Like, do I really need to know about what determines the chicken's egg color? And do I, what's the appropriate ratio of feed versus straw? You know, those kinds of things. But she incorporates it in a very interesting way. And I think where you end up, and it's interesting, like, that your first novel had the phrase fragile things. I think she's in this period of sorrow, you know, but she's not really expressing it in any way except for to turn her attention to these chickens. There's so much about all the ins and outs of caring for a creature that is kind of a foreign object to you that it's meditative, but it's also kind of heartwarming, but also a little bit alarming at times, because, you know, chickens die. Even healthy chickens don't live forever. But when you're new to raising chickens, there's a lot of errors you can make. There are lots of problems that can happen where, you know, something might break in and eat your chickens. And so, of course, things like that happen. And there's this one really bad storm where she thinks the chickens are gone, but they have buried themselves in the mud so that they'll feel safe. Just like, oh, chicken. And then, of course, the word brood is, you know, brood is like your children. You can call your brood. You often call chickens a brood, but it's also what we do when we're thinking, when we're pondering, when we're upset about something, it's a word that we use as our, you know, what we're doing, our we are brooding. So that's kind of in there too. I don't know, you know, last year my big pandemic book was The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, which was a memoir.
I was just thinking about that as you were telling me about this.
Yeah, because it was, you know, so small and focused on one thing and it slowed time down. And I think in a lot of ways, this book has that same kind of effect, even though it's doing different things and, you know, it is fictional. But there's this scene near the end that I just found so moving. I don't want to spoil it exactly, but she has to give her chickens away because they're probably going to move and they're going to have to move quickly if they move. And so that, I think, says a lot about her connection with them. And yeah, it's just, I don't even really know what else to say about it. I'm finding myself having a hard time. Let's see, what did I say in my review?
It sounds very touching. And like she's working through a difficult time and these chickens have given her someone to take care of and they depend on her. And so it's given her this connection to kind of reach outside of herself.
Yeah. And I think it connects to kind of what we were talking about with the direction that people come to things. I think, you know, it's possible that this character is more of a like processing things through facts. And so she's talking about the facts of these chickens, but it's almost like this shorthand to get to how she feels about herself. Mm-hmm. And like, what does her life mean? Like, let's say she doesn't have children because it kind of seemed like maybe this was her last attempt or something. You know, what happens when you have to think of your life differently than you were hoping to think of it? Like, it goes really deep. I felt like it went really deep. I think I've seen some negative reviews where people are like, this is just about chickens. Like, what is happening? And I just don't think it is. I think it's going a lot deeper than that. So I think it's more of a question of like, if it's the right book for you.
Right. So is it written in an engaging way? I mean, because it sounds like there's loads of facts about the chickens themselves and how to care for them.
Yeah, it's very internal. So it feels very much like you're in her head.
Okay.
And so the other characters, even though they have names, they are very far away, even though, you know, the friend comes to visit because obviously she's concerned about her. And then I think her friend has a daughter that's, you know, really into the chickens. And then, you know, her husband is present and doing his best, but they don't feel as real as the chickens do.
Right.
Which I think is true about grief. I think that people have this period where they can't let people into it.
Right.
That just isn't the right thing to do at first or something. So in some ways it's a book about grief too, which I love good books about grief. For people to be able to articulate those kinds of concepts, I think is really helpful.
So, you know, I was just thinking about how in the grief process, it's hard to let other people in on that. But at the same time, even though she has a husband, if you've had loss, you know, she might be feeling like she doesn't really have a whole lot of a purpose at this point or something, you know?
Yeah. And
I know oftentimes when people have had a traumatic situation happen to them, that if they get a pet, it's what's keeping them going because it depends on them and they're needed.
It's so true. It seems so simplistic, but there's really something to it, I think. And these pets in particular, there's this one moment where she hears one of them screaming and she jumps out of bed and goes outside like within a minute, you know, just an immediate gut reaction. Yeah. Like she's really there for them.
You know, it reminds me, I've got a friend, gosh, she's in her 90s now, but when she was in her 80s, her kids and grandkids got her chickens for her birthday. And she said she had one that was kind of special. And the other ones picked on it. And she said it was so hard to see that. But at the same time, she said when she would go out to feed them, that one would run up to her and jump up for her to hold it. And so she would hold it and carry it around while she fed everybody else. And so she's like, so tell me who isn't the smartest one. That's always been surprising to me, my friends that do have chickens. How affectionate they can be.
Yeah.
But
I guess when you poke around another animal's nether regions enough, like you just form a bond. That is such a weird dynamic. I don't know.
Yeah.
But let's move on to your second book.
Okay. So for a book club last month, we chose the first volume of his Paradise series by Ellen Hillenbrand. And then for book club this month, everybody wanted to know what happened in that story. So we chose the next two volumes. So we have been working through that series. And basically the gist of it is this lady in Iowa City, Iowa, her husband's has previously been a corn syrup salesman. They've got two sons that one's grown and married with a child now. And the other one is off teaching skiing in Breckenridge or something. Anyway, her husband gets a different job and is now making a lot more money, but he's traveling a lot. She gets a phone call from the owner's assistant to tell her that there has been a helicopter crash and that her husband has died in a helicopter crash in the Virgin Islands.
Oh, no.
And she's thinking, a helicopter crash in the Virgin Islands? What is going on, you know? So it leads her and her sons to the Virgin Islands, where they discover he's leading another life there, still under the same name, but he is so wealthy. He's got a villa and a mistress and a daughter. The mistress was with him on the helicopter and they died. So there's this whole story of them trying to figure out what's going on. And, you know, did he really just die from the thunderstorm? You know, the helicopter just crashed, or was there something more sinister about it? So it's a pretty good story. There are some good surprises there. And the thing I loved about it was each chapter, it doesn't always alternate, but the chapter is entitled by the name of the character who's talking. And I love this about it because you get to know each of the characters and the events that are happening, you get to see how they each perceive them and what they think about them and stuff. Really lovable characters, which is important to me. And a satisfying ending. I was really happy with it. So that was a fun one, more like a beach read.
Yeah, sounds like it. Like the best beach, St. John's, right?
No kidding. So, oh, yeah. And it was right there on St. John. Really good. Really good.
So are these considered like crime novels, or what would you categorize them as?
I wouldn't necessarily say crime. Let's find out.
Because yeah. I mean, I would guess romance just from the cover. Oh, I guess Goodreads calls it chick lit, mystery, romance, contemporary. A little bit of everything, maybe.
Maybe chick lit, I guess. But I liked it just from the standpoint that there's a lot going on and you get to see how they work through them, through the issues, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it would be considered chick lit.
And we can just call it contemporary. That sounds nicer. So does your book club pick books meeting to meeting, or did you postpone something else just to stay with this series?
Actually, how it had turned out, we all volunteer for 1 or 2 months out of the year. And by the time this particular member went to choose her months, there was only, I think, these two left. And they were back. So gotcha. It worked out so great. It really well.
But those sound great.
We've done that before where we've just decided we want to finish the rest of the series. And it was a good one. I've never read anything by her before.
Mm-mm.
I have heard her name come up and other friends have read her and just love her. So she's a fun one.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Probably a great summer read. I've been working on putting a list together for summer. So
yeah, you might try anything that she's written. I would bet it would be good.
I'm really curious, like if they ended up living there, but I won't ask you because it's probably a spoiler.
Well, you know, I will tell you, they get there and find out he has this villa. So like, they're living the high life, right?
Yeah, because everyone who lived in it is dead, right?
And so, yeah, it changes their lives for sure. But yeah, I'm not going to say a whole lot more.
Well, great. That sounds good. Thank you. One of my goals for this year is to read more of the books I have with the theme of music, because I've been collecting them for a while. And I've done, you know, like a recommendations episode about books on music, and I'd gotten more ideas from that. So I was being a very good person and checking in on my reading goals the other day, because that's what people like me do. I think that's the Enneagram 3 people.
Are you a list person?
Oh yeah, I love my lists. And I realized I hadn't read a single book for that goal, and I only give myself 5 goals. So I was like, well, I have this pile, which book can I read? And so I picked The Ensemble by Asia Gabel. It's from 2018, has a bright yellow cover with these beautiful flowers on it. It's very striking. And it's about a string quartet over the years. And so there are these 4 people, the same 4 people. Jana and Henry met as undergrads, and Britt and Daniel are the other 2. And all 4 of them end up forming a quartet in their kind of like post-undergrad conservatory time. And they are working in the beginning to compete in this competition that kind of makes or breaks quartets. And so every section is a different era of the quartet, and that tells you what year it is. And then the author also provides you with an LP. There's like a round LP with a few quartet pieces on it that are actually included in the chapters at some point. So that's really cool. So I sat down and I made myself a little playlist so that I could listen while I read, which of course I always really enjoy. I was a music major in college, and quartet music is some of my favorite. So what I really loved at the beginning, there's this whole page that I marked, because not only was I a music major in college, I accompanied a lot of people. So that meant lots of hours in the practice rooms with them, lots of performances where I had to be, you know, right in tune with them, catching them if they messed up. One of my favorite people to work with, one of my best friends in the music department, once skipped an entire page of his aria in his recital. And I knew him so well that I knew exactly what he had done, followed him there. And the only person that knew any better was his teacher. Those kinds of relationships come from a lot of time that you spend. And it's almost like, I would use the word intimate. It's like an intimate relationship, maybe not like a boyfriend exactly, boyfriend, girlfriend, but it's like you know each other's breaths and movements and thinking, because you have to stay in tune and perform together well. And so it's just a different way of knowing a person. Like you have to really read their cues, like especially in this quartet, they talk a lot about whoever's job it is to start a movement. How it's going to go depends entirely on how quick the breath is, the direction that their arm took, things like that. So they're super in tune to each other. And so, of course, the 4 people go in and out of like having relationships with each other. There's a few external people that they have relationships with too. And so, of course, that can sometimes throw off the group dynamic, or if they're having a hard time, that can throw off the group dynamic between the 2 of them. And so it actually follows them into older years. Sometimes they're together because they're like the guest performers at a summer camp or a festival of some kind, like a music festival. And then the book goes toward them competing in this quartet competition another time, their final time. And so there's a lot at stake. And I think each of the characters feels differently about whether or not they really want them to win, because it comes with a lot of performances and time commitment after. And of course, they have lives too of their own. Yeah. So I felt like it's a great capture of what being in a group like that long term is like. I also was thinking a lot about another book about a quartet that I love called An Equal Music by Vikram Seth, which is a bit of a longer novel, but also very beautiful and talking about the relationships between people and the music itself. I think it's an interesting challenge to explain a piece of music without the music. And so I felt like I understood it pretty well when the author explained it, but I would be interested in knowing how someone who doesn't have a musical background, how it felt to them. I would be interested in knowing.
Well, you know, I'm sitting here listening to you thinking, how did they describe it? How would you even do that?
Yeah. I'm like, do I even remember? Because they talk a lot about how pieces start, because that often, you know, has an impact later. There's this one where like one of them has an injury that he hasn't been disclosing because he's worried that it's really serious. And he misses this one passage and they all hear it and they see the look on his face and they know that something bad has happened, but they have to keep going. And so it's like you're inside their heads as the piece is kind of unraveling. It's really kind of a very skilled thing she had to do to try to bring people in. And I should say, like, similar to the book you were talking about earlier, it does rotate between the characters' points of view, which I think is really important because they don't all see it the same way. I think even the music, one person's kind of he was like a child prodigy. And so things have always come really easy for him, where some of the other people really have had to work. And so that changes your perspective, you know, just by itself. So
does that create any dissension among them where things come easily for him and the others have to work so hard?
Yeah, because the quartet is supposed to be kind of an equal partnership. But if you have someone who's always been kind of fawned over, that can create some strangeness. And of course, you know, there's a question of, is there an imbalance in talent levels? Like, should one of these people be going and doing a solo career? Are the other three holding them back? And I think one of them is always trying to figure out if they're going to leave, when. Yeah, so there's a lot of drama beneath the surface there, I think.
That does sound really good. Do you like it when you get to see inside the different characters' heads?
I do. It's one of the things that really works for me. And I know some people feel like it's a cop-out sometimes, but I really like it. How about you?
I was thinking about this the other day because I really like getting to see other people's perspectives on things because there are so many different ways to see things. And that helps me understand why they react the way they did on certain things. And when you're just getting one person's view, I think I like a book that's either told from third person or directly from multiple perspectives, as opposed to just one person's perspective, because I feel like that's so narrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's not that I wouldn't still enjoy the book, but I think those are the ones I enjoy more. Because
yeah, you want to be able to see all of what's happening.
Right, right. Yeah.
It can be a little claustrophobic to be stuck in one person's head, but sometimes that's what the author wants to do. Like with the book I was talking about earlier, it's entirely in her head. And that has a very, very specific effect, I think.
It does. It works really well for stories that are, oh gosh, I'm trying to think, that was it, the girl on the train or the woman?
Yes.
You know, where it's just in her head and she's not a reliable narrator. That makes it really good for those kind of situations.
Yeah, it wouldn't have worked the same in another way, probably.
Right.
Well, let's get to your last book. What do you have?
Okay, I am almost finished with The Unexpected President by Scott S. Greenberger. It's about the life and times of Chester A. Arthur. He was president for a short time, but what led me to this book was the book previous to this was Destiny of the Republic by Candace Millard. The Candace Millard book was written in 2011, and the book I'm currently reading was 2017. So a few years difference, but Destiny of the Republic is about President Garfield. And he died just months after gaining the presidency in the 1880 presidency. The subtitle on this is A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and Murder of a President. I just love this book. For being a nonfiction book, it was so readable and kept me turning the pages from it approaches those three topics. I mean, you're talking about this very delusional guy that ends up shooting the president. So you get his story, you get medicine. It's talking about the medicine they used to treat the president and the ideas of medicine at that time. And then also about James Garfield, of course, himself and the politics at that time. And so these two books that I, you know, I finished this, The Destiny of the Republic, and then went on with the second one about Chester Arthur, who was Garfield's vice president, because I wanted to know what happened with Chester Arthur, because Garfield sounded like such a noble man. Chester Arthur, as his vice president, was very much loyal to the party. It was a faction of the Republican Party called the Stalwarts. Very much a party man, and actually a puppet to Ross Conkling, who was the leader of that party. Mm-hmm. And so when he became the vice president, he really wasn't so much loyal to the president at all. But when the president ends up being shot, you really see some emotion in Chester Arthur. And he received some letters from a lady he doesn't even know, who is encouraging him that as President Garfield dies and Chester Arthur is going to become president, she's encouraging him to become the noble man that she knows he can be and to really serve the country well and that type of thing. And it's such a load on him. He's so emotional about the whole thing. He doesn't want to be president. So he's mourning, you know, he's mourning his friend, the president, who's passed away. But he's also terrified of having to take the presidency. And surprisingly, he really steps it up. So I was really taken by this because I can't wait to see more about what he does during his presidency. It appears at this time that he cuts his ties with Ross Conkling and is determined to serve out the presidency in the manner that Garfield would have done it.
So is Chester included in the list of presidents?
Yes, he is.
Forgive my lack of knowledge.
You know what? I'm awful. I can't even tell you what number he was.
I don't think I've ever heard his name before, honestly.
So I was just curious about that. I mean, what was fun about reading these two books back to back is that you're seeing all these people's names that you've heard in the past, but they're all within the same circle and period of time. Mm. And the Destiny of the Republic book was so fun because, you know, there's the science component to it where it brings Alexander Bell into the story.
Oh, cool.
But Alexander Bell meets Garfield at there's a celebration that they do. It's kind of like a world fair, but it's a big science thing in Philadelphia. And he's presenting his telephone. And it just takes off after that. So you get a lot of history on Alexander Graham Bell. Things that I had never really thought about before, how his true passion was teaching the deaf and the blind. Mm. And he actually had a school for the deaf. His mother was deaf enough that she had to use one of those horns to be able to hear very well. And then his wife was completely deaf. That was his real passion, was teaching them. And he received a phone call from a man that had an 18-month-old daughter who, from scarlet fever, had lost her hearing and her sight. He connected her with a teacher named Annie Sullivan. So can you guess who that
is? Oh, it's Helen Keller's teacher.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was obsessed with Helen Keller when I was little.
Well, it's just really kind of neat to see this other, you know, to learn about these things that are happening during that time.
Yeah, that's really neat.
And so what his association in the story with Garfield is that in Garfield's last days, he's doing everything he can to invent a device to try to locate where the bullet is inside Garfield.
Ah.
And then, of course, the other component is Charles Guiteau, who is the madman, basically. You get his story. He is just something else, how delusional he was. He was sure that he writes a note and says he really has no problem with Garfield, but President, but Chester Arthur needs to be the president to save the country. Wow. So he shoots Garfield, and then he has sent a note to General Sherman asking him to send his troops in to collect him from the train depot and deliver him to the prison. He's just so sure they're going to be, you know, right behind him, that he's done the right thing. And oh my gosh, he's just crazy. Then with the medicine too, the other thing that blew my mind was by the end of this book, it was pretty clear in my mind that it wasn't the bullet that killed Garfield. From the moment he gets shot and the doctors arrive, they are probing in him on the train floor, you know, the train station floor. He's on the floor and they're probing in there trying to find the bullet. And at that time, they hadn't quite accepted the idea of germs, these bacteria and things that you couldn't see. And so in the end, I really believe he died of sepsis.
Mm-hmm.
Man, he really was tortured through this whole thing. It was awful. But The book was wonderful. I learned so much. The other thing that kind of was exciting to me is at the time he gets shot, Todd Lincoln, President Lincoln's son, is there also. He's been through an assassination of his own father, but he's the one that collects the doctor.
Oh, wow. So everyone's just connected.
Yes. And so the unexpected president, when this leads in during that same time period, but it's all about Chester Arthur. And boy, he really has some questionable ethics. I mean, he's quite a wealthy man, but you find out how he got that wealth. Something that it brought up in this was about his appointment as his position. He was the head guy at the customs house there in New York City where they would receive the shipments and people would pay their fees. But it was really rigged up to be quite the deal. They would have to pay the fees. If they couldn't pay the fees, their things would be put into a warehouse where somehow they would disappear and be sold on the market.
So he could really advantage himself.
Yes. And the other guys, it was all part of the party. Anybody that worked there at the customs house, part of your pay went to the party, sort of like, you know, a percentage, 5%, 10%, whatever it was, it went to the party. So they were very big on that. And I didn't understand what the spoils system was, but that was a very big thing at the time, which, as I understand it, was you didn't really have to be qualified to get a job. If so-and-so wanted you to have that job that was in part of the party, you were obligated to. If you were a leader in the party, then you could say so-and-so should have this job. So then when he becomes president, Garfield had already begun cracking down on things at that customs house. And he carries through with it, I guess. I haven't gotten to read the end of it yet.
I guess you'll know soon.
But I think the whole thing for me about this is that people can change, that he can redeem himself. I'm kind of excited to see that happen.
So are you trying to read a biography of every president, or did these just capture your attention?
It just captured my attention first with the Destiny of the Republic about Garfield, because I am, you know, embarrassed about how bad I am on my history. I just don't know history very well at all.
Oh, yeah. And definitely understand that.
That book was so readable and really captured my interest. And then when it mentioned that Chester Arthur changed his colors, I wanted to learn more about that. So that led me to the next one. Yeah.
Funny how that happens.
Yeah. And it has been really interesting because I don't know, politics and all that stuff, it just frustrates me and overwhelms me to the point that I feel like I just can't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to me that the Republican Party was so powerful and corrupt at that time.
And that they had a subset. I don't think I knew that. So interesting. So other than finishing the Chester Arthur story, The Unexpected President, are there any other books that you're already reading or that you're excited to read next?
This stuff has taken me a little while to get through it. The nonfiction is a little heavier, right? Mm-hmm. So I just had heard, I get most of my recommendations off of podcasts, seriously.
Oh, totally.
I just heard about this one that I thought would be really fun to just listen to on Audible. They said the narration was really good. It's called The Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osman. And so far it is pretty cute. Just some older people that end up meeting on Thursdays and they discuss murder. And then it sounds like it's leading them into where they're trying to solve murders too.
Oh, fun. Gotta love old people solving murders.
I know. They're so funny. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. So this is, it's weird to say it's about murder, but it's light and funny.
Yeah. I totally get it. Last night, I started An Inventory of Losses by Judith Shalansky, translated by Jackie Smith. It's one of the books that's on the long list for the Booker Prize, but the name sounded so familiar, and I was reading the introduction, and I realized that she is the author of one of my favorite nonfiction books called The Atlas of Remote Islands, which is literally, it's written like an atlas, and it's all these islands that are either hard to get to or on their way out. Yeah, just fascinating, fascinating book. And so this book is actually similar. It's nonfiction and it's about things that have disappeared or expired isn't quite the right word. And so, like, so far I've read about this island that is documented by, like, Captain Cook and from these other accounts, but it's gone. And also the Caspian tiger. And so she takes all the facts and kind of turns it into, like, she brings you into the Colosseum, for instance. So that's pretty fun. But it's kind of like little entries of different things that are now lost to us. So,
is it like a collection of short stories along a similar theme?
It's not really stories, though. It's really much more nonfiction, more like lyric essay. I don't know. The lines are kind of blurry sometimes. But yeah, so I'm enjoying it so far. I checked out 3 books from the library that were all on the long list, and they're all pretty small and petite, which I like because I will get through them more easily. Well, Carol Ann, thank you so much for coming and talking books with me today. I've really enjoyed it, as always.
Oh, this has been a blast. I appreciate it. Someone that will listen to me.
Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode, at readingenvy.com.
Hey, there's a dog.
Yeah, sorry.